Welcome to RGM. Are you in a band? Come and join us. Simply click on the RGM submission page, submit your music, and we'll sort the rest. Hello. Oh, and Alex Leek off there, didn't we? Hello. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. You found us again. Thank you. Thank you for staying subscribed and getting this new podcast again, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the RGM Experience podcast, where we delve into the grassroots music industry and beyond and find interesting people within it to share conversations with you, the music-loving people out there in the world. And yeah, we didn't have a show last week. I did mention on the previous 150th episode with Vida that we're going to be not bringing a weekly show out for a little bit. I just need to get into this new house and get it sorted. It's causing me a little bit of stress, you know. And I've got a lot on at the minute, so I'm... So I've just parked it just to keep myself sane, because it's a lot of work producing a show every week. And it's fine, it's going to come back. Oh, it's going to come back. We are having conversations with new guests, and there's some exciting things. You know, I'm bound to say that, aren't I? But please do stick around. Don't unsubscribe or all like that, because we are going to be coming back every week with a new show for you from my new studio. When I say studio, I mean spare bedroom in the new house when that happens. So it's exciting and stressful times at the minute for me personally. So thanks for hanging around anyway. So we are bringing you a show this week though, ladies and gentlemen. And it's a good one. Every now and again an interview lands on your lap that you weren't expecting. And subjects come up within these type of things that you weren't expecting. And today, ladies and gentlemen, we have a chat with Dean Fairhurst from Standing Man. He used to be in a band called Sly Digs. And in Sly Digs used to be Ryan Breslin from the K's. So we'll talk about that a little bit. You know, they've got good mates and that, you know, they've toured the world. And we do speak about this a little bit with the K's episode on a previous in the archives. Delve into them. Some good stuff in there. When they were out there in the world supporting the Who. Liam Gallagher, Def Leppard, and all these type of things. And there's some good things to come out of this podcast, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm just going to list a couple of you, just to tease you a little bit. He had a bit of an altercation with John Mayer. He tried it on with his missus. John Mayer tried it on with Dean's missus. So that's all coming up. That's going to be talked about. John Squire has ripped off his tune completely. We'll talk about this. So Dean's got a song called Changing Wind. John Squire brought a new tune out with Liam Gallagher, Just Another Rainbow, and it's uncanny, proper uncanny. In the description of this podcast, I've put a link to both songs on there, so you, the music-loving people, can make your own mind up on it and have a listen to both, and you tell me what you think. Share it with us, tag me and Dean in, tag Standing Man and RGM into it. It's uncanny, it's absolutely uncanny. Interesting, and Dean's a nice lad. I really enjoyed spending an hour with him and having a chat. And I think you'll enjoy this chat as well, ladies and gentlemen. So if you're new to Standing Man, he's just brought out a new album, which is available, and it's class too. So here we are. So loads of stories about being on tour in America with The Who and that. Loads of stories about John Mayer, John Squire. What more do you want? So kick back. Have a cup of tea. Depending on what time of day it is. In fact, no rules. Have a beer if you want. Kick back wherever you are, on the bus, the train, the gym, wherever you are, listening to this, whenever you are. Kick back. And today, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to introduce you to Dean from Standing Man. Take it away, mate. Hi, mate. How are you doing? You all right?
I'm very good, thank you. And thanks for having me up.
You're very welcome, mate. You're very welcome. I'm intrigued by you, Dean. you've got this big, long story and history and music that I'm excited to introduce the RGM people to. And just, I know your album, as we're recording this, your album's just dropped today, brand new album. A few funny stories that I'm topics I'm going to bring up around the album in a bit, just to tease people. So hang around, people. You're in for a ride on this one, ladies and gentlemen. All right. So, hi, Dean. So if anybody's new to Dean or Standing Man, introduce yourself to us, mate. What's it all about?
Well, my name's Dean First. I'm the lead singer, songwriter of Standing Man. We started just sort of out of the pandemic era. Did a little bit of an album, recorded that, and I had a vision of it sort of previously, but before we started the ball rolling. But I started writing quite quickly for it. Then we started to see what the live performance would be like. So played one or two sort of shows supporting some upcoming artists.
Yeah, nice.
And then formulated from that. I always think that, you know, trying to find how it works with a group of people live is a good starting point.
Yeah.
And then sort of parallel to that was also the structure of writing. I wanted to come straight out with an album and a body of work that tells a story.
Well, then, a lot of people started to write more in the pandemic because there were fuck all else to do, basically, weren't they?
And
we've, you know, our podcast started over 150 weeks ago during the pandemic as well, when we wanted to speak to people and find out what people are up to. And my biggest fear was we were going to have loads of albums come out describing the pandemic. It's not like that, is it? Like, the end of the world and all that bollocks.
No, it was an escape from that, You had to dig deeper a little bit into your own psyche and all the experiences and all those things to find an escape, which was cathartic in the process of creating, I think.
Yeah.
That's how I use it, sort of a drug in some respects.
Well, away from all the terrible things that happened in the pandemic and people getting ill and that kind of stuff, it wasn't all that bad for everybody. People got time to themselves a little bit more. People had time to try different things. We were told by the fucking government that we had to retrain if you're a creative person and all that kind of bullshit we had to deal with, didn't we, and all that kind of stuff. Some good stuff has come out of it. You know, obviously, you know, pay homage to the people that, you know, were ill through it and all that kind of stuff. But away from that, you know, a lot of creative things happened and people fought back against those messages we got from above. Like the government telling us that we should be doing proper jobs and not, you know, reskill and, you know, work behind a bar and just do the normal type of things, which I fucking hated that side of the messages that were coming from the government myself.
Yeah, it was, because it's just so out of touch and it's not anything new.
Yeah.
Rather than getting all political about it, but it's not anything new, which is sort of, I was glad they said that, because it really shows, you know, that side of our civilization.
Yeah.
Differences more. You don't really have to dig and go, do they really get us? They don't. Clearly they don't. And the fact that they don't know how worthy arts is.
Yeah.
The art fucking world is. Yeah. And it is. It's imperative. It's imperative for our existence. It's imperative for culture. It's imperative for getting through hard times, getting through the good times, remembering things. It's all music's nostalgia, isn't it? So, you know, and of course you're going to remember bad times and you're going to remember good times. And that's the process of life. And having a soundtrack to that is imperative.
Yeah, I get it. And just to linger on this, you know, like moving on from all that kind of shit, the government and, you know, governments, you know, they're all fucking wrongins, aren't they? If you just look back in history, and they have kind of shown, played the cards, aren't they, with that kind of stuff. And they do try and take money away from the arts and the creative industries and the music venues. And if they can get rid of something first, they'll attack our industry, won't they?
Britain is in that state, really.
Yeah.
Where, you know, everyone's going, oh, fuck, the music venues are... They're depleting by the minute, and there's no infrastructure being put in place by ultimately the people in power at the moment, and how they foresee what the future holds. It seems like they're running around like fucking headless chickens. So I think you've got to fight against it, and I think artists fight against it in any way they possibly can, just by the ability to keep digging and striving and creating and putting music out in the world now. So then, I suppose in dark times, what comes after it is always it's always interesting to see from artists around the world and what they come up with. So I think it's maybe just a part of that process.
I if you look at it with like a just looking back to the punk era, you know, that those times were bad, and then punk came out of a certain kind of era when things were depressing and all that kind of stuff. So it can be a silver lining, really, or it could be. And there seems to be a lot of people fighting back and having a voice now and coming out with albums. And like the K's this week of, you know, going for a number one album with the Libertines and that kind of stuff. Like bands that have like really, really just progressed over the last couple of years, and they can still do it. There's light at the end of the tunnel when they try and knock us down. And I just love that fighting spirit around the music industry. I just think that nothing's going to stop them, really.
Yeah, it's fighting the systems, isn't it, in place? That's whether it's from a political point of view, and in this realm, is certainly there's bands out there that are grafting to get recognition for the music, and it's great, you know, it's great to see people gate crashing the charts and all that stuff with the K's, but more importantly, it's putting platforms in there to keep creating, keep putting out music, keep developing your skills as an artist and making it into something that's interesting enough for it to affect people. So yeah, that's the escape from it all. All the rest of the bullshit gets dealt with, you know, by having the ability to put a record on or listen through it to get you through your life, I suppose.
Yeah, well, just let's rewind a bit. Let's zoom out a little bit. So where do you call home, Dean? Where are you based?
Currently in Warrington.
Oh, nice.
In between Liverpool and Manchester,
Yeah.
so we're the
That's better.
bastard children of Manx and Scousers.
Nice. And did you grow up in Warrington originally?
In a little village called Burton Wood.
Oh, nice.
There's about 3 second names throughout the whole village.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was very so, and it's sort of it's on the cusp of Warrington. On the outskirts, just in between Warrington and a place called St. Helens, and a little bit more countryside. Yeah, but it's good.
I've been there
It was.
once. I went to watch BDI there once at Parole. Is it Parole
Oh,
in Nashville? Yeah.
yeah, I
I went to
remember
that
that when that was
BDI
on.
gig. That were a messy one. I had a good drink around town in Warrington that day. It was a nice big rugby town, isn't it?
Yeah, big rugby league town.
So what was it like for you, like growing up in a smaller town than these big cities that you see on the outskirts of your little place you call home?
The positives were that, you know, it was, you're not too far distant away from sort of countryside and a bit of nature, I suppose. But then in other respects, it is a little bit secluded. There's not a great deal going on. You know, if you live a little bit closer to Manchester, Liverpool, you have to travel. So growing up and getting to the age where you're heading out and chasing the opposite sex and all that stuff. So, you know, it was quite a lot of industrial things. So I think in that element of boredom or the importance of boredom drives you to find escapes and whatever that is. And that was music came quite quickly as the forefront of my mind.
How quickly, how old were you when you realized you've got this thing inside you that's burning?
That I need to do to create them. So it's funny, really. My father was a used to work down the pit. Then he became a rugby player. Funny enough,
Oh,
a professional rugby player playing at
right.
Wigan and Warrington as captain of Warrington, I think. And then and my mother was a hairdresser, so no, nothing creative. I have like a brother who works in the acting industry and he's a theatre director. So we're very both creative. So it's strange to think how that happened. And then I was, we were both, me and my brother were both playing rugby at a younger age as well. As you said, like Warrington, not being a rugby team, rugby sort of town. And then so at the age of about 16, I think, but before that, I was a bit obsessed with music. So I'd always be stealing records off my brother. Or the good thing that what my parents did have is that they had a good taste in music. So my father would he sang in an Irish band. That's the only connection I have from my family that anyone would do from a performance point of view. He sang like sort of in an Irish band, singing a lot of traditional Irish songs and stuff like that. So I'd see him at a younger age, playing in the pubs and stuff like that. And then I was just I would hear a lot of the music coming out of the car radio or at home and stuff like that. So I started to get an obsession with that. Then the Beatles came.
How old were you then? What, just to.
From a really young age, I was sort of introduced to music at like 5 or 6, maybe seven. So little memories of having little records around when you had like vinyl players, stuff like that. All those newer style vinyl players, they're all plastic and a little bit shit. And someone stole it. I remember someone stole it. It was like a big thing. And then so then my brother was into music, so he's a few years older than me, so he was the one, he had money to buy records, so I'd always steal his and do all those things. So, and then when I started to go to high school, I became more and more obsessed, so it just grew and grew, and I wanted to absorb music in the sense that we had like sort of tape players, and the story I tell quite often, which I think most kids did in those days, where you'd have the sort of headphones through your sleeve, have your tape recorder, you'd be swapping the tapes, the cassettes with your friends at school, and just have my headphone in my ear, leaning on the side while I was in class, and the teacher wouldn't know. I'd just be listening to fucking tracks all day and different albums. And then I got friendly after a couple of years in high school with a friend called Louis Menga, and we became very close just through the connection of music. And we were start we just I don't I can't I don't think there was an exact point where we were like, right, let's start the band. It was like, oh, let we got connected over the music. We were both obsessed with the Beatles, both obsessed with Rolling Stones, loved Dylan, all those things, and blues and all that stuff. So we were learning at the same time. He'd learned a little bit of guitar before because his father played like flamenco guitar. So then I sort of mithered my parents. Mum bought me an acoustic guitar down in Cardiff because my brother was going to university there. Anyway, I got it, and then we just locked ourselves in a bedroom from then on, and started writing songs before we could even really play. It was more about the magic of songwriting and the actual songs of how does that something that someone's created there change you, something inside. You listen to it and it affects you, and you're like, fuck, I want to do that. That seems ace. And then you get obsessed with the documentaries constantly, watching it. The only thing I would watch is all documentaries of films. So then
What
for
were the people like around you at school when you were getting into music? Was that like, were you on the outskirts of society with that kind of stuff, or
yeah,
was it
definitely,
quiet?
yeah. It was sort of a time where music was getting bigger, and it was at the time when like the Strokes were coming in, I suppose, and then Libby Eanes and Arctic Monkeys and stuff. That's when we were just getting older. But at the time in high school, there wasn't really that many people into music. Well, into the type of music that we were being attached to. It was more like hip hop and rap, which I listened to as well. I sort of enjoyed a lot of that. I think when I was really younger, I went through a phase thinking I was fucking Eminem at one point.
Nice.
But not, I wasn't doing any rapping. I'll assure you of that. So yeah, it was just the obsession came quite quick, and then it was just more about absorbing as much as possible, and when you're going through those teenage years, it's like, it's you against the world, isn't it? And that gives you a little bit of an anchor to mean something in the world, and you mean something in the world. I don't know what it is. It's the magic of music that people can obviously talk about to the end of the day to try and understand, but I'm still on that journey of trying to understand it, I suppose. But and then I carried on in that journey of delving deeper in influences of the bands that I like. So a lot of sort of the Afro-American music and all the blues, and how that the resurgence of that and the history of it always fascinated me. And yeah, I'm still on that journey. I'm still on that obsessive train, so to speak, wanting more and
I
more.
I think I am as well. You know, I did like after my band split up many, many years ago.
Yeah.
It never really leaves you if you've got that kind of personality. And I can remember getting I can remember the lightning bolt that got me into music. Somebody passed me a tape. Where's your song? Shaker Maker? Something like that.
Yeah.
A really old one with a tape on before Definitely Maybe come out. Said,
yeah.
Can I have a listen to that on a tape, you know, back in olden days when that were just all we had. And it's just, you know, I can remember it vividly, just like, fucking hell, this is good. It changes your life. And the power of that, to have that and want to, you know, offer that to other people, that's just amazing, isn't it? It's just an amazing thing.
Yeah, no, and I think the bands, obviously, that I got obsessed with, they were like, you could see there was a connection there saying, oh, they could do it. Certainly, like, with bands like Oasis that come from, like, a working class background, it's like, it's that incites the idea that, oh, I can actually do that then, can I? Or is there a chance that I can do that? So you're going to fucking follow it, so... It's all their fault, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all their fault. Yeah, blame them. And so what was like, so you met your mate, getting into music, you know, developing these things, you get your guitar. When was the like first time you played a few chords together and wrote a tune? Tell us through how that happened and what was the name of the band as well?
I was thinking about this the other day because I seen him quite recently, Louis, and then we like structured the band together. But we play predominantly in his, and we were sort of learning together, and we'd be like, oh, I've learned this chord, do you know this chord, and he'd show me something, and I'd show him something. But we had like a little tape recorder, so we put like cassettes in and record it, and you know, we record over the track, and then we'll find a riff. So we did that pretty soon after realizing that we were learning how to play instruments. So we started writing some tunes straight away. And then obviously at the time you go and show like your family or whatever, or showing his family, and they'd be like really supportive, going, oh, that sounds really good, you know, carry it on. So we quickly just started writing different things, trying, you know, just learning the trade, so to speak. And then we got into gigging. I think our first gig was, our first gig, after we sort of put the band together, we got like a lad called Adam in playing the bass. We had originally we had like a drummer called Chris who he played. Neither of them could fucking play either, but they weren't as in. They wanted to be in it because it always sounds something new and young, but they weren't in it as much as me and Louis would. So we obviously sort of drove that, and we did it. The first gig, it was from the bass player's mum had organised. I got us a gig in a pub in fucking, what's it called? Someone just, it's on the way to Manchester. And anyway, we turned up to the show and it was like, we set up the equipment. Everyone's all a bit nervous. The drummer's fucking nervous as well. He was always nervous, but trying to not show it. And we played the first set and I remember it was the roughest fucking pub you've ever been into. You know?
Yeah.
It was like all the scallies around playing pool. Yeah. Halfway through the set, one of the scallies, just the one who thought he was the artist, I suppose, comes over and is going like, "Turn that shit off!" I laughed it, I loved it, because it was people that were watching it and people enjoying it, and then you know this sort of kerfuffle going on with these scallies. And I remember the drummer not wanting to go on. He didn't want to go on in the second set because his ass had gone. And I was like, "No, it's fucking it's good. Come on, we've got to do it. We've got to go through it and fight through it." And I think for like a good few years, that was the most money we got paid for a gig. Yeah. It was like, I think it was about 800 quid or something like that for like a couple of hours a set. But then I quickly got intrigued.
Were it just covers in that, by the way? Was that just like covers?
I think it was a bit mixed covers and mixed of our own songs just to see how they go. Yeah. They probably were a little bit shit, but you're supposed to be, I think.
Yeah,
you know?
You are, yeah.
But there was something in there. I remember writing some songs that I eventually started getting sort of notoriety in Warrington and in Newtonley Willows, where we started getting a fan base, and they started to travel around with us. Then we'd just take coach fulls of fans from from like Newton, Warrington up to Manchester or to Liverpool and even down London and Everett, Sheffield and all that stuff. So we because it's because you have to be those duplicit that duplicitous person in being a businessman in the industry. Even then you have to be it. But you wasn't caring about that. You had no fucking idea of what that. It was just more about let's just go and play.
And what was
So
that band called?
that band was called Sly Diggs.
Oh, is that Sly Diggs? Oh, okay. I've got them to talk about in a little bit because they progressed a little bit, didn't
No, we did well.
they?
But that's how the starting point was like the trajectory was strange. We went through, we got ourselves in some funny situations. But yeah, it was great.
So funny situations. What kind of funny situations?
Oh, fucking hell. There's so many. So many. Well, when we sort of really started to get good, so to speak, we realized that we needed more equipment and rehearsal equipment, recording, whatever it was. And the best way to do it, we found, was you would get more money and you would be treated better in doing tours in Ireland, funny enough. And it was at the point where we're still doing covers in the set. Because you go to Ireland and you're asking for X amount for, a couple of hours a set, you need to fill out that set. So you can't really play, two, three, even longer. Sometimes we play of our own music. We just didn't have that much music. And then, people are going to sit for 3 hours and listen to music they don't hear, they've never heard before. So we'd mix up a set, and then we did a few tours in Ireland, and that was like the Hamburg time for the band.
How did you find out there's opportunities in Ireland coming from Warrington and actually making that happen? Because
I
it's
think,
not cheap to do those type of things. If you if you're going overseas, if you're nipping over to Ireland over there, it has
No,
it has its
it was good
costs and
money. Yeah, it was good money. So, and there was we I think it was still using the internet. Might have been MySpace then. I think it was just after that. But people would email us or and ask us to do, and my father was traveling over there as well, so he had sort of little bits of connections trying out in pubs, and it's that usual thing of parents, trying to help out. So that was a major part. And then, we were just touring around there. We'd rent a or we I think the drummer bought a van, and like a long wheelbase van. We'd have like a shelf in the middle, the gear underneath, and we'd sleep on the top. And we'd just travel around busking in Dublin, and then when you busk in Dublin, people will come and see you
Oh,
and say,
nice.
"Oh, come and play at my venue. Do this." And just as is the beautiful nature of the Irish, they're always sort of welcoming, and we'd always invite us, and we'd get invited to people's houses, and you stay there one
Oh,
night, we'll book
nice.
showers in this place, and we'll get a hotel now and again if we rent a little bit more money, and we lived off like fucking cooked chickens and Guinness for a good few weeks, and it was a time where it really cemented our abilities to have tightness in playing together and enjoying just being young, really. Getting yourself in situations that are a bit crazy. I remember playing in a place just
That's what I'm getting to. Tell us about a crazy situation, mate.
outside.
Come on.
I remember playing in a place just outside Dublin, I won't mention it. But the guy there, he picked us up from busking, and he was saying, "You're right, great, you guys." And he liked to drink. You could see, he had those sort of signs, telltale signs. And he was like, "Be careful a little bit." But oh no, that was it. We did the show, smashed the show, and halfway through the show, there's a very sort of strange looking character watching, and I'm seeing him through the show. So we do the first hour, and he's still watching us, not really getting involved in like the crowd, because they were like the older people and they all be on like popping all sorts of stuff and getting drunk, and it was like a crazy scene. This place out of Dublin that we'd never been to before, packed out place. And I kept seeing in the corner of my eye this guy, and he was just watching the whole set, not moving, very, very quiet. And then halfway at the set, he sort of comes over and goes, "English boy, very good, very good." Then walked off. And I was like, fucking thought nothing of it. And then the owner came up, and he was like, "Fucking hell, what did he say to you, that bloke? What did he say to you?" And I said, "No, no, he just said the set was good." He was like, "He's part of some very, very naughty the sort of places in with regard to the IRA sort of thing. And the bass player at the time, we changed bass players, and his family have, had some like crazy stories and beautiful stories of those fighting back for the Irish, because he's got a lot of Irish family over there. And it was just in those moments where you're lost in the excitement of it, and then someone just tells you something, and you're like, no, but it was good that they enjoyed the show, I suppose.
Nice one. Yeah, good work. You won them round.
Yeah, no, and we would be living in the back of all the vans and traveling around and chasing girls and doing all the things that you do as at a young age. And yeah, there's loads I can't tell,
No, fair enough, fair enough. Well, that's all right. That's all good. It's all for the history books, and it's all for the book one day, eh?
yeah, mate, yeah, yeah.
So, you mentioned Sly Diggs there, because when I was doing a bit of research on you and that, just having a
Yeah.
trying to do me interview bit and that, and
Don't.
obviously, the headline from is Sly Diggs supported many big legendary bands. So before we
Yeah.
get to that side of things, how did you progress as a band to being an opportunity to supporting the likes of The Who, Def Leppard, Liam Gallagher, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. We just grafted like you've got to do in this day and age, and I've done for a long time, and it's just gigging, and you've got to keep producing music, keep putting out certain music, doing the video things and putting stuff online. And it was more of like the conveyor belt of creating. So we were enjoying ourselves and we were putting stuff out online, and we went from like one sort of tour at like a toilet tour of the UK, and within like 6 months we were.
Was that like a self-funded headline tour that you'd booked yourself, or did you have
Yeah, no,
people working you?
I think like a local sort of promoter had put us on, and then a few of the gigs were good in the local areas, and then we played like a place in Doncaster, and the fucking sound engineer didn't turn up, but we're all like bastard, fucking smashing the gaff up, and we went from that of going it's a little bit soul destroying, going playing into an empty room, and then playing to a room that's quite full, and people are like wanting to see more, to play into an empty room. And then 6 months later, we got offered to play. I think the first gig we did was it was Echo Arena, but it came from just posting out online. So we posted a video. I think it was a song called "Stiff Upper Lip," and they and someone that worked with the management at Sin, with the Who's management, had seen a video out on Twitter, and then passed it to a few people, and they liked it, and then they got in touch with us, and then they wanted to come and see us.
Let's just hang around that a little bit. So
Yeah.
that's very rare to hear those type of stories, isn't it? Where
Right.
when somebody puts a video out and it gets picked up by
Yeah.
these big massive bands management team, and they want to
Yeah.
work with you and that kind of stuff. They usually have they're quite loyal to the labels and that kind of stuff, and they put a little bit of smaller bands on from the labels and that kind of stuff, don't they?
Yeah.
Generally, I suppose.
Yeah.
How did tell us more about the mechanics of that, if you can.
Yeah, so I think it was they passed it on, so the Who's management got interested in us. Of they were not necessarily, as my understanding, that they were not necessarily looking for any artists to invest in, because they were managing like the Who, UB40, Judas Priest, and so they were working in that realm, so they weren't really looking for someone, but they were. It ignited their interest just from someone passing on that one video, and then they looked into to the album. So we released, so we signed to a label called Flickknife Records. Frenchy Claude is his name, nice guy, sort of in small indie label, and we'd sort of rushed our first debut album, which in my eyes was all demos. It was all, they were all demo tracks that. And I've listened to it quite recently, actually, and there's some like great songs on there, but it is demos. Like there needed to be edits of like lyrics that are a little bit shit. Some of the recording of it in general is demos, but the songs are really strong. So I think they could tell there that there's something in it. So from that, watching that video, the management had looked into what we'd had out there in the ether, right? And they love that album. They really love that album. So then they got in touch with us, just contacting from emails. Sorry, just to go back to the point where there was a woman that worked in the industry, and she worked for, she usually just PR, Emily Smith, her name was, and she passed it on to someone that was working at Trinifold, and then it just sort of went through that management, and they got interested, and it's they instructed us to say, look, we want to come and see you live. And we started having a few shows down in London. We were getting a bit more notoriety then, and we did a show in London, the first show in London that they sent a few people down. And as was our luck, it seemed to be our luck, because we always seem to do things the harder way,
Okay.
either by our own fault or just by the nature of what we were doing. So then we do the show. Guy apparently turns up to the show. We're playing I think we go through the first song, and then fucking electric goes off and fire
Nice.
alarms go off, and fucking gig gets pushed back to another like hour. So then we try and get back on. Electric's back on, and finally we do the gig and we smash the fucking
Nice.
back out of it. Great, loves it. Guy loves it. Okay, someone else from the management wants to come see us. We'll organise another show. Then the second show is at a festival down south. So we're all traveling down from the north back down to it's down the south of this festival. I think it's like Jamie Oliver's big festival. That's what it
All
was,
right, okay.
which is strange anyway. You know, very sort of calm ethos of a festival. And we start traveling down there in the van, and then we get caught in like five different fucking traffic jams, and it's like panic. We literally panicking to try and get there, so we're like an hour late. By the time we get there, we're just fucking, it's stage time, so we've got to get on. You're all fucking
Nice.
sweaty and all that, just crawl, jump out the van. And anyway, we do the gig, and we play, I think, did we play just before, do you know the band Dodgy?
Yeah, do yeah.
Yeah, band Dodgy, they I remember just playing just before them. Anyway, we go on, fucking smash the gig again, and we're like, yeah, nothing can stop us. The guy from the management loved the show again, so we,
Nice.
you know, we did everything else. The guy out of Dodgy was like, yeah, I really like some of them songs, mate. I said, I don't know whether he's a singer or not, but he was like, you've sort of robbed off Elvis there, haven't you? And I was like, robbed off Elvis? I'm nothing like Elvis, but anyway, I'll take whatever you take it. And anyway, it was very nice, and we chatted for a bit. But at the same time, I've been chatting with the lead singer of Dodgy. Some of the other lads, they hadn't had a beer, so then they were like running. They'd be sweating all day, and they were like, we had no riders. So they went in the backstage, unbeknownst to them, I think, and just fucking completely demolished all their riders. So then by the time Dodgy came off, they were like, bastards, they fucking stole our rider. Like, it happened. But yeah, from there, we went and then we had a sit down. We went to the offices in London, which is a little bit daunting because it's top of a high rise sort of very fancy building.
Do you have to have a wash and get smart and that kind of stuff, right? That
Yeah,
kind of
we
like
had to get,
corporate thing,
you
yeah.
know. Yeah, no, definitely. And we sat around in the offices that are surrounded on the walls by Gull Records and people from Led Zeppelin and all these, and the Who, of course, and you know, just the whole walls are full with all these types of records that we've seen and have been obsessed with since we were younger. So it was a bit like, yeah, we're in it. And they told us that they liked us and they wanted to see how we'd go with supporting the Who. So we put us on a few dates around the UK. And of course, the transition from playing these sort of smaller venues to an arena, you have to learn quite quickly because there is a difference. And if your performance is right and you're close-knit as a band, then of course it did well. And I think, you know, staying true to ourselves, we just grew very quickly of playing in those arena shows. And that was like, you got the taste of it then. So like, I think, you know, playing and being able to sort of command bigger audiences, it's not that easy, but you either take it on and deal with it and get better, or you know, you fizzle out and you shoot yourself. But no, the first gig that we played was it, I think, at the Echo, well, it was the Echo Arena, I think it's the M&S Bank Arena, something like that. And that first gig, everything that could have got went wrong went wrong. You know,
Okay.
I think like fucking guitar string snaps on the
Yeah.
first song, and fucking lead guitarist pants fall down, you know, just fucking all. So everyone's like panicking. But I remember going on that stage, and where you think you'd be panicking, I wasn't. And I think from then, I've never really got nervous. And I think it was like, well,
Nice.
if anything goes wrong, it's like, it's out of your control. You just got to be able to deal with it. So I like that. I was like, yeah, if you're in that mindset of being on the stage where anything goes wrong, you deal with it. And because the audience just see every little bit, even if you're slightly nervous, you know, and it doesn't make them feel comfortable about watching a new band. So the more comfortable you are, the better, the more invited the audience are, so to speak.
Did you get a chance to speak to The Who, or did they stay out of the way?
Not on the first couple of shows, we didn't. They had a lot of security and stuff, but then when we did, we started getting reactions quite quickly from the audience, like big reactions. Yeah. So when we got invited to do the American tour, that changed the level. We went up another level from a performance point of view, and The Who and everyone else, that they could hear it in the auditorium, so in the arena, even in the backstage, the crowd went fucking mad for us. It was like 19 standing ovations, like all going crazy. So of course they you know, Peter came into our dressing room, and some of the lads have had issues with visas getting over there in the first place, and we missed the first part of the tour, which was in like New York, Madison Square Gardens. Wow. Bastard, you know, go ahead. But anyway, cut long story short, we got the second half of the tour, which was you know, a couple of months. So Pete, when we first got to the first date, I think it was in Toronto. Yeah, Pete came into the dressing room, was like chatting to us, and very sweet. And Roger, we was chatting with Roger and Zach, and they were all very nice. Yeah, Pino Palladino was playing for them as well then, the bass player, who I'd known of, because he's just a virtuoso, fucking excellent musician. Yeah. And
any words of wisdom from these legends?
Yeah, no. I remember it was funny.
Oh, just something daft.
Yeah, it's not daft. Me and the bass player with smoke. We fucking chain smoke like mad. So, and then I remember that Pete saying, it took me ages to get off those fucking things, but I'm glad I got off them. The only thing that got him off was tobacco, you know, chewing tobacco. Like, yeah, I think he's going to smoke. The worst one, Ben, you know, he's going to keep smoking. But no, it was, they were very nice with us, and sort of, they were excited for us, for the reaction that we were getting, and like people coming back and saying, you know, I've not seen a support band like that get a reaction, and it was, you could tell, we'd sell merch after the shows in like a certain section of the arena, and we'd tell people on the mic and run over. And by halfway through that tour, it was like people running after us and pulling your hair and everything, and fucking, like, it was like a Beatles moment, really, as a support band, which is quite crazy, you know what I mean? So,
how do you take to that kind of stuff? You strike me as somebody that enjoys that kind of stuff. The notoriety.
I'd rather enjoy the reaction of like being in the arenas. It doesn't really bother me. I'll speak to anyone, of course, and do the signature thing's weird, because it's like, why do people want that? I think they just want something from me, I suppose. But no, of course, I get it. But at the time, we were like, yeah, just to sell more fucking CDs. We need some money.
So nice. So, so Sly Diggs, so The Who, talk us through the other people that you've played with as well then.
So from that, we came back. We did, we got invited to play the Teenage Cancer Trust at the Royal Albert Hall with Def Leppard. And there was loads of people backstage there. It's all good about the Teenage Cancer Trust, so. You know, we were happy to support a great charity. And the guy we were speaking to, the drummer out of, I can't remember his name, unfortunately. We were speaking to the drummer out of Def Leppard, and he had his parents there who watched the show, and the parents loved us, and we were like meeting backstage with all them. Everyone at that level is always usually nice, you know what I mean? You can get arseholes, but that was the one thing that we didn't really meet, any proper arseholes, except John Mayer. John Mayer, don't like him.
What did he do?
He was chatting up my bird.
Oh, was it? Oh, right. Okay, fair enough. Right, okay. So how did that end up then?
I fucking didn't see him. I was running around the arena trying to find him. Yeah. No. Oh, good. He's a good player. He's a great musician. I can't take that from him. But no, it's a funny moment. It's a funny thing with regards to me and John Mayer. And he doesn't even know who he was. I think he wants to see us play as well. He had some derogatory term to say about us. Fucking. Anyway, John Mayer. Asshole.
I'm purposely leaving a long pause just to see, just to dwell on that level. It's funny. It's part of it, although not everything's going to be roses, is it? You know, it feels like a tiny little blip in an amazing like part of your music career. Really, that.
Yeah. No, the journey is as enjoyable as the shows themselves.
Yes, you know? exactly. So the Who then? So you played with Def Leppard, Liam Gallagher.
Yeah, we went over in Europe and playing at what was the hottest day I've ever experienced in my life in Milan. Wow. And
was that with Twisted Wheel?
I did. No, that was.
Were they on as well?
No. It was the Killers.
Oh, okay.
Killers played as well. Liam Gallagher and Richard Ashcroft. So we met Richard Ashcroft, nice. And he was dead nice, and we had sort of mutual friends. Because he grew up, obviously, he's from Wigan, and there was a guy, a good long-standing friend of ours, who's like a producer, John Kettle. He was in a band coming up in Wigan at the time when Richard was coming up with the Verve, and they had like a bit of a to-do in like the local press, and they were like fighting for notoriety, and Richard had said something in the newspaper, and there was like confrontation, so we brought it up, and he was there, and he was like, "Oh shit, yeah, John Kettle, yeah." He's a lovely guy and a very talented person in his own right. So that was good. And then we were trying to meet Liam, but he had like his entourage was too big. So we were like, Liam, I don't know what he was. Well, no, we didn't get anything. But I remember speaking to the guy out the Killers. That he was all right. I was a bit pissed at the time, telling him that he had skinnier legs than our drummer, Peter. But sometimes the Americans don't get our humour, do they not?
Yeah, so
I was a bit offended. No, but it was a top show. But it's so hot, it's extreme. I had a blazer on as well. Oh, that was it. He was telling me, the guy at the Killers was like, "How have you just played that full show with your full jacket on?" I was like, "I couldn't get my jacket off. It was like body. It's like cemented itself to my fucking body in the gig."
Yeah.
But yeah, we then went on to do some stuff with Scorpions, which were a bit different than what our musical. Genre or so to speak, but fuck, they had a lot of fans, the massive Scorpions. So playing in Paris and play that, it was part of the tour. So we were doing the festival season, then we did some dates in and around the festival season with Scorpions in Europe. So I remember we did like the main stage at Isle of Wight, went down in the same day to France, played the gig in Paris, and straight after the gig, went straight up to Scotland and played like Transmit Festival, I think it is. And then after Scotland, went back to fucking France. It was like four or 5 days of just complete travel madness.
So, because obviously you do Standing Man now. So how did that band not be around anymore? Just talk us through how it ended.
So we just, I think it was a difficult time really from getting into people in and around us from the industry. And, you know, we had a booking agent that we just sort of signed to who did quite, you know, he understood us, understood what we were as a sort of band. And we weren't indie, but we weren't like classic rock. We were somewhere in the middle and, you know, he tried to and did great things for us of putting on the shows and stuff like that. And then it became a little difficult because we, after the Who thing, the sort of dark side of it was that we didn't really have anyone on the ground working for us. And we were just a little bit naive. Yeah. So obviously coming back from the Who thing, we were supposed to have like a tour of the UK and starting our own tour. And that didn't transpire by the time we got back and too many months had elapsed where the ball had sort of got dropped. So obviously you're coming back on what is a very successful tour from in the US and got us like a load of fans over there. And then coming back to the UK and nothing really being in place. So we didn't have, and that's what it is in the music industry. It's like, you can't do it on your own. Even if you're the best songs in the world, you have to have the team around you, and that has to build, and you have to keep an eye on that. And I think we were unfortunately for us, we missed, we didn't have that full structure of a full team round us, I think, that cost us, and that cost the it cost keeping the ball rolling. And then it becomes a little bit more difficult of like mentally, I think, you sort of feel aggrieved by missing opportunities. And then it gets to the point where, fractions start happening in the band, and you think that, it just got a little bit too much for me, I think, mentally. And I think for all the other lads in the band, and we're enjoying ourselves more than what you really have to do. And I think it came to a realization that if you're doing anything, especially in the music industry now, it's great to think that you're living in the 60s and you've got people just taking care of everything. But if you're not there, you've still got a graft. And I think we lost that as a group, as a collective, to understand that you have to graft a little bit more. You have to be a bit more savvy and understand that the sharks that are in and around will only lead you down wrong paths and all that stuff. So me personally, out we were playing some of the shows, and I think the last show that I was thinking that I needed a break from it was we were playing with Roger Waters at well he was playing at Headline in British Summertime, and we got on one of the side of the stages just before Squeeze, and it was like technical issues, but it was like ridiculous. And I remember looking back and the guitar tech was distracted chatting to some Burns, someone else was distracted, and then it just the gig was like it was painful as fuck. And I remember getting a little bit emotional playing that last song, and thinking I need a change here because it's going down the wrong route. And a month later, I sort of sat down with the lads and said, maybe we need to just stick it on a hiatus at the moment. And not no detriment to them. It's more of where I was mentally, I suppose. If you haven't got the drive to do it, and things became harder. So it's like the conversations in the band became harder. Trying to solve or trying to all sing from the same hymn sheet became harder, I suppose. And I think that was built out of frustration out of all of us, knowing that the fucking balls kept getting dropped. So I just I sort of wanted a little bit of a break, and then was visualizing pretty much after that I have to do something else. I couldn't still get away from this need to create and fucking drive and do this thing, whatever it the fuck it is inside me that makes me want to create, that I have to start something else. So
So did you go back to like a day job and that kind of stuff then for a bit or
But it was pretty hard, I've got to say. It's like a breakup. It's like how I can imagine what a divorce is like to some degree. Because and we're all still very close. We're all still good mates. Obviously, Peter came with me, the drummer, out of Sly Diggs, and he's in Standing Man at the moment. But I'm still close with Louis and Ben, the other lads that are in the band. Louis doing something else now at this moment in time. He started out a new band. I started thinking about, right, just get straight into something else.
So it never leaves you. You just have to try it again and have another go. And how do you feel the transition from being in Sly Diggs into Standing Man? How's that been for you?
It's strange, really, because you've spent all your career life in music, having certain people that you buzz off and connect with. That was me and Louis, really. We were of the same mindset creatively as well. Louis wrote songs as well, and I co-wrote with him and wrote on my own, all in Sly Diggs. So not having someone to buzz off or bounce off, that was quite daunting. But then working with these lads that we started Standing Man with was good, because it was just a new, fresh, different people. Now Paul, the bass player, he'd taught Ryan, the lad out of the K's,
Oh, nice.
because Ryan out of the K's, he came to America with us, and he
Yeah,
was
I've had him on
like,
the podcast before. I was going to ask you. He played with the Who for a bit, did he? Or like supporting her or part of the tour?
No, it's part of Sly Diggs.
Oh, right. It was actually in your band as well. It was in Sly
Yeah,
Diggs.
yeah. No, no. It's just that's how it, that's his connection with there. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Right.
So he played keys over there and came to America with us because that's Ben, the bass player of Sly Diggs. That's his brother.
Yes, it's all flooding back because I did. It was over a year or so ago. Last time we talked to Ryan about it. He's a
Nice,
nice
yeah.
lad, isn't
Yeah, he's sound, boy.
he?
Right, talented lad.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, where was I? I think I was
Yeah,
saying about.
we're just like transitioning and getting and starting this thing, Standing Man, really.
Yeah, so I wanted a straight off the bat. I was like, well, I can keep ringing. I know the industry is more designed now for like constantly getting content out and all
Yeah.
singles and
Yeah.
EPs. And I was sick of EPs anyway. I was sort of getting, I was like, right, if I'm gonna fucking do something, then I want to sort of create a body of work, so to speak. So we started writing different tracks and different songs, and the first sort of batch tracks were all right, but they weren't what I was looking for. So some of them got scrapped, and one or two had this element of this sort of tinge of psychedelia, which it was interesting to me at the time, and is, and I wanted to create something that was like rock, but also this thing that I was going through at the time and listening to different records that I was usually listening to that incited, just playing around a little bit with tonality and different effects sound wise and push me in the direction to start what would be the journey of recording the debut album. So
So
yeah, we
the new album's out today.
it is out today, yeah, finally out there. We waited a long time, that's how long it was,
As
so.
it, so how long has it been record finished and recorded, mastered, and to release day today? How long's that been?
From when it was fucking finished, it was in the everything was in the can and all sorted. It's about 2 years.
Wow.
We've been sounding for about 2 years, and that was more from like people in the industry saying, sit on it, don't release it, keep tracking on. And again, it was more of like the album is, and as I view it, and certainly this band, it's like it tells a story and it's the start of the story. So I'm not releasing this album and fucking looking for album charting and anything like that. It's not the case. We're not big enough at this moment in time for that. So I'm not really that interested in the chart thing. I just wanted to get it out for people to understand the start of the story. And that's what it all is. All these, bands, it's stories, isn't it? So I think it's a body of work that gives people an understanding of who we are, what we are, and what we're about. And I think it's good to just get it out there so people can go, okay, who are you? I've never heard of you. And then you've got a full body of work rather than just a couple of singles and something like that. I just wanted to do it different,
So, do you listen back to the album a little bit now, and want to change anything? Because it has been 2 years at all.
Yeah, fucking always want to change things.
Just haunting
Constant.
yourself every day, like, I wish I did
Constant.
that. I wish I did this.
Massively insecure. No, but I listened to the album not that long ago, and I was like, it's fucking really good. I've given myself a gap from it, and then go right entirely. Let me just listen to that album. Came across it again on my phone, driving in the car, and then I listened to it in its entirety, and I was like, it's fucking really good, that album. I really enjoyed it. And then you think about the enjoyment of recording it,
Nice.
and I'm glad that we can actually get it out. Because it's sort of a little bit of closure as well. Because if you've been sat on an album for 2 years, and you're like, "Fucking hell, we've got to get this album out at some point," and we got it out. It's a little bit of a closure. Get it out to the people. It's not yours anymore. Then they can they it's up to them whether they fucking like it or not, or listen to it or not.
Oh, nice.
But closure.
Yeah,
It's
nice.
love.
Well, one of the singles that came off the album, "Changing Wind," was picked up by Noel Gallagher, I believe, and that brought some eyes towards it. Did it get added to some playlist or something I was reading up on?
Yeah, it got added to like Man City playlist.
Oh, nice.
Oh, I think there's only two footballer fans in the band anyway. Me and Joel, and both Everton fans, so
Oh,
yeah. So we're not United fans anyway, so
okay.
had a bit upsetting when it's fun. But yeah, no, that was good. It was good to see that the track's getting listened to and getting a little bit of notice, I suppose.
Yeah, well, one interesting fact from the album as well that was brought to my attention before was John Squire brought a new song out with Liam Gallagher recently.
Yeah.
And it sounds really familiar to another song that's already been out there. Yeah. And it happens to be, and I've listened to both songs again this morning before interviewing you.
Right.
He's ripped you right off there, hasn't he, Paul?
It's pretty, there's a lot of similarities to the riff anyway.
Yeah. So, As soon as the song starts, it's the exact same riff. So your song Changing Wind, the riff on it is exactly the same as John Squire's song, Just Another Rainbow. That riff, amazing, class riff. But it's when you do listen to it back, it's just like, wow, it must be nice to have somebody like that ripping you off.
But it's funny, isn't it? I don't like. There's only certain realms within music and riffs and genres and melodies and stuff where there's going to be similarities, inadvertent similarities, right? So you're going to get that. There's many a time I write a fucking song about, fucking love this.
Yeah.
The melody's ace, structure's ace, and then like after a while, I listen back to it and go, that's completely that other song. I've just realized, bastard. I've got it. So there is that element.
It's not just the riff, though. It's like the whole melody
and
everything.
Thing, it's the timing of it, the old riff as well. It's a bit like, well, fucking hell. If he has done it and he has got it, then you know, it's a fucking compliment. It's John Squire and he's great.
Yeah.
I think Changing Wind's a fucking much better track.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So can you like report that kind of stuff? Who do you report this to? Ofsted? Is there an Ofsted for music? What do you do? What's the problem?
Loads of people came out about it when it came out. It was like, when did you write fucking my song? And I was like, fucking way before he did.
Yeah.
So that just, like, put that out there. it was written far earlier than the John Squire started.
What I'll do in the description of this podcast, I'll put a link to both songs, and people can make their own mind online. Yeah,
let people choose.
Let the people decide.
They're gonna say their song's better because they've got bigger fans, but I fucking don't believe it.
funny. Yeah, but when, like, you know, what a, you know, one of the greatest guitar players in the world. And John Squire. See what I did there. So it must be a nice compliment, if anything. Anyway.
Yeah, 100%. I love John Squire. I love Liam Gallagher as well.
Yeah.
But pay me a little bit. How much did you get paid for it? Maybe a little bit of royalties.
A little bit of that. Yeah.
Wouldn't go so far. Yeah, considering the style. But no, I wouldn't chase it and go into legal battles of trying to claim anything back. No, I'm not that person.
Yeah.
No matter what, even if it was a huge hit, I probably wouldn't do it. Even if I was a pauper, it's just not in my vocabulary. So good. If it is and it's influenced him, I'm chuffed.
Yeah.
But either way, man.
Well, also, there's going to be a link to in the description of this podcast on YouTube, or if you're listening to it on the audio version, click on the link tree as well, because you've got a big tour coming up. You've got the album out now. We want people to share it. It's going to be on. It's on RGM Live right now. Our review of the album, we fucking love it. We think it's great. We're going to be shouting about it. Just talk us through. Now it's release day, the album's out. What's it like for you now, having this tour ahead of you and the album actually out? It must be a relief.
Yeah, it's a relief. It's just like the starting point of it. Yeah. I think, you know, it is the journey is really beginning for Standing Man. So getting out and doing our first headline shows is exciting. Nice. Starting next week in London on the 18th.
Nice.
But yeah, let's get, you know, we want to play around the UK and all those fans that want to see us and do those things, but to be able to play the album and have a longer set, you know, a bit more songs from the album, maybe a bit of newer stuff that we're working on, but being able to go and perform and also people where they can find out what the story's about. So that album, I stand by it, and you know, hopefully people like it and love it as much as we did and we enjoyed recording it.
It must be a really nice space to be now. It must be. How do you feel now, like confidence wise, and you know, having more history within the industry and having that experience with you know, with the previous band and you know, and learning from everything that happened there, are you taking all, I presume you've got to be taking all that into Standing Man now and just feeling more confident about things and knowing knowing what to do, really, and how to map out your future as a band now, I suppose. It must be. I kind of think there's a question in there.
Yeah, no, I know what you're getting at there. I definitely from the experience point of view, you know, you've been through it, and mistakes are the ones that, you know, you learn from it.
Yeah.
Not really, you know, there's that saying about you don't really make mistakes. You either win or you learn, don't you, so to speak. But I've made enough mistakes to understand where there's pitfalls, but there's always new mistakes to make.
Yeah.
And then there's that other side, because it is an industry, because it is just the maddest industry in the whole fucking world, the music industry, in the respect of, you know, it doesn't run like the normal business world does, so to speak, or anything like that. Even different arts as well. So there's always that element of luck, and always that element of people, you know, that are important, that can change the transition of your trajectory with a flick of a hand, so to speak. Then we just hope that gets out to the right people. Mm. And a lot of it will be luck, but you've still got to be good, and you've still got to create good music. Otherwise, you're not really going to get anywhere, I suppose. But for me, it's more about being able to go and do it again. That's what I found. After all, you know, experiments and all that thing, it's taught me that I've got to enjoy the process and not get too lost on, we've got to make it, we've got to do this thing. Of course, I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't want to make it. Yeah. I didn't want to fucking, whatever this make it is. Mm. But making it me is making it, being able to continuously do it and generate, you know, money for it so you can live.
Yeah.
But being able to get in a studio and having the ability to go and work with different producers and different things and record and do that beautiful process that is recording. Yeah. And then also going to traveling the world. Traveling the world for me is a big fucking thing, and always has been, because it's absorbing other cultures and it makes you a little bit more understanding of why we're fucking all here.
Yeah.
You know, not get too out of it.
Well, congratulations on an amazing album, mate. I implore anybody to listen to it. There's a link. I'm going to point you again to the link in the description of this podcast, ladies and gentlemen, where you can download the album, you can buy a ticket for the tour, just check out the dates. All over the country, is it? Everywhere?
Yeah. London, Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester on the 26th, 27th is in Leeds, and then Edinburgh on the 28th.
Nice.
Start something good.
There we go. So congratulations on the album, as I say. What an amazing story you've got so far. Let's kick off this next chapter in your life, mate. On and just enjoy every minute of it. You're a talented lad, and I really enjoyed getting to know you, Dean, today, mate.
Oh, thanks very much. Thanks, Carl.
Is there anything you want to... All those people hovering over the link that haven't pressed it yet, mate, what would you say to them?
Just press it. Click on it and dig it, mate. Switch it on and enjoy yourself. Put it on at a weekend or at the evening. Go and enjoy it.
No,
let us know what you think.
Dean Ferris, standing man. Really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today, pal. Have a good one.
Cheers, buddy.
Oh, cheers, Dean. Told you. Loads of interesting things in there. So there we go. Someone new to introduce you to. That's what it's all about, isn't it? As always, thank you for staying around to the end of this podcast and tuning in. We really appreciate it. The video version is on YouTube too, so if you'd like to watch our faces, you can do it there. And we've got to be away for a couple of weeks now, so as I've mentioned, so do delve into the archives if you're missing us or you're missing a new chat. There's bound to be something you've not heard or got involved with in the archives of the podcast, so just delve into there for a couple of weeks, eh? If you need anything, you know where I am. I'm on the socials and RGM. I'm still going to be powering through with all the RGM stuff. I just need to park something just to keep myself sane at the minute. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get off and get back to the solicitors, see where they are with the whole fucking thing. And to you, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another week here at the RGM Podcast. We will be back soon, I promise. Thanks, guys. Toodaloo. Welcome to RGM. Are you in a band? Come and join us. Simply click on the RGM submission page, submit your music, and we'll sort the rest.
Hello. Did you know that you can support our podcast in many ways? Within the description of this podcast, you will see a list of all the equipment that we use. These are Amazon affiliate links. Clicking on these links take you to Amazon. If you buy whatever you're planning that week, we get a small kickback and you get a parcel at no extra cost. We would really appreciate your support. Or you can just go old school and donate a pound or whatever you feel is appropriate in there. Please subscribe, tell a friend about our show, and thank you for your support, and we will see you next week.
Or in a few weeks.